Hi everyone, welcome to the Idiots Podcast, that's infectious disease insight of two specialists. I'm James, that's Callum, and we're going to tell you everything you need to know about infectious disease.
Soon may the editing come to discontinue the Tazo Sun. One day when the CRP's done, we'll take our leave and go.
Callum, how are you doing?
Oh, I don't have a pun ready.
I have been looking forward to this, because I figured that this was the episode that was going to finally break you.
The next episode is an easy pun. This one...
Do you feel like somebody's torturing you by pouring concentrated acid all over your lower limbs so you've got acid knee toe?
Acid knee toe.
That reminds me, Callum, this episode's an acidita batter, is it not?
Oh, that's so bad.
It is bad, but you had nothing, so I felt that I had to step in, and also I've been thinking about it all week.
You've been thinking about it all week. Oh.
Well, like these crap puns, just as with you, pop into my head and then I have to get them out. Mm. Any suggestions that that's why we started the podcast are scurrilous rumours, which we'll not respond to.
Just like source control, you have to get the pus out. We have to get the puns out.
Just so, Callum. So, this is the second in our Nobbling the Non-Fermenters mini-series. And we have previously talked about Pseudomonas, and we did a sort of quick introduction to the non-fermenters, which we are not going to go over again, but there is a sort of overview in the prep notes that you can have a look at. The four big families that we're going to discuss are Pseudomonas, which we've discussed already, Acinetobacter, Stenotrophomonas, and Burkholderia.
They're like the there four are... houses of Hogwarts.
Yeah, exactly. There are a bunch of others, which we've gone over before, but usually they are treated as pseudomonads in the lab and are, you know, of limited importance, let's say. So, Callum, why don't you tell us about Acinetobacter then?
So, Acinetobacter, so there's 32 species at the moment, and of those, 15 of them cause human infection, and there is a whole lot of names. I think probably the one that you'd be most familiar with is Acinetobacter baumannii.
Yeah, or specifically Acinetobacter baumannii calcoacetius complex, or ABC, which is now what everybody's trying to call this. And this is the thing that we're going to be talking about later on as well.
Yeah. So, you know, and then there's a load of other names, which James put in the prep notes. I don't know what they are. Should we read them out to you? Do people like us reading out back to your names in a big list? Maybe
I don't know.
Relaxing.
Somebody in the recent feedback said that sometimes we make them sleepy. So perhaps as a cure for insomnia or a side gig as an ASMR podcast, perhaps we should go through these names. Will I start?
Okay, let's do it very quickly then.
Fine. Baumannii.
Calcoacetius.
Hemolyticus.
Junii.
Johnsonii.
Lowoffii.
Radioresistens.
Bajoringrii.
Berezinii.
Guillain-Barrei.
Nosocomialis.
Parvus.
Pittii.
Schindleri.
And Ursingii.
There we go. Right.
And these are the 15 that have been noted to cause human infection, but by far and away the commonest is Acinetobacter baumannii calcoacetius complex, or ABC. And that's kind of what most of this episode is kind of based around. Yeah. So where'd you find them?
Well, they're sort of like most of the sort of pseudomonads, non-fermenters, they're environmental organisms. So they love a little bit of soil. They love a little bit of water. They cause infection through fomites as well, water fomites. So fomites are objects or materials which are likely to carry infection. So that can be clothes or furnishings. Mm. And they can also, if people have got wet skin, they can be colonizing healthcare workers' skin in the infectious intensive care unit. So that's a potential risk, person-to-person transmission. But
that really explains why they've got this preponderance for being in and, you know, intensive care. So the you know, the risk factors for Acinetobacter, it's, you know, prolonged hospital exposure. So that would be ICU admissions, particularly stormy admissions where you're sick and then you're getting better and then you're getting sick again. Lots of lines, so opportunities for colonization and entry. TPN, probably as a surrogate for, you know, an unwell patient who's partially immunocompromised, and heavy antibiotic use, particularly carbapenem use. Mm. Yeah. And that, but that's all for sort of hospital. Who would get it in the community?
Very rarely. I don't know if I've ever really seen it.
Well, this is actually a much bigger problem as a pathogen in tropical regions where it's a very common cause of pneumonia. So one of my bosses was telling me that he was dealing with Acinetobacter pneumonias in sort of Southeast Asia kind of all the time. And yet you come north and then it's just doesn't seem to be as much of an issue.
Yeah, the climate is so important. So I guess if you're going to get in the community, it's particularly prevalent in those with lung disease because you get sort of abnormal lung mucosa, it's wet. So particularly smokers, alcoholics, people with diabetes, and, you know, as James mentioned, tropical regions. Although that said, it's not a very pathogenic organism. So most of the time it's causing nosocomial illness, so infections acquired in the healthcare environment. And it's not something that, you know, you see as a very virulent organism. It's more, you know, when people are immune compromised or their barrier is gone.
Yeah. So if you think about an alcoholic smoker who has uncontrolled diabetes, they've got, you know, bad lungs, sugary tissue and impaired immunity. And then all that can kind of combine to predispose infection to, amongst other things, Acinetobacter. What kind of clinical syndromes does it cause then?
So it's mostly, you know, respiratory disease, lower respiratory tract infections, so ventilator-associated pneumonia, hospital-acquired pneumonia, and around 80% of the organisms are sort of drug resistance, difficult to treat. And I think Acinetobacter in general is difficult to treat anyway. Mm. Community-acquired pneumonia in tropical regions, and it can cause a tracheobronchitis in children, apparently.
Yeah, I think that's a tropical thing as well, but don't quote me.
We've recently talked about Kauti in a detail, and you know that's plastic in a place where there shouldn't be plastic, so it can cause Kauti, nice wet environment. CNS infections, so particularly in the context of prosthetic material like a ventricular access device or something like that. And then skin soft tissue infections, so in patients with burns, you get this sort of really abnormal skin, so a lot of sort of gram-negative organisms, you know, including Enterobacterales, but also including your non-fermenters can infect burns, and that can be really problematic. And the real challenge of that is knowing, like, what's colonizing versus what's infecting. You've written here people inject drugs, so I guess, you know, if you're breaking the skin barrier, I have to say I've never seen that. Maybe that's more of a tropical region thing as well.
Well, maybe, but then I think also if you're regularly injecting into the groin and forming a tract, and there's lots of groin organisms there. Some of them can be gram-negative. And if you're not sterilizing your injection materials, then they can be colonized, or reusing them even worse. They can be colonized with, amongst other things, Acinetobacter.
I guess with any infection, it can lead on to a bloodstream infection, a bacteremia, and that's usually from chest or intravenous lines. And I think we've given a lot of sources there, but by far the most common one is chest and line, I would say.
Yeah, VAPs and HAPs are the lion's share of Acinetobacter infections.
Micromorning aged.
Micromorning aged.
So a gram stain of the Acinetobacter is a gram negative bacillus. It can be gram variable. We think of gram staining as a completely dichotomous thing, but there's probably a bit of a, you know, it's more complicated than just gram positive or negative.
Yes, annoying levels of nuance, one would say.
Yeah, like most things, once the more you learn about it, you realize it's more complicated than you thought. They're short and plump and coccal bacilli. So sometimes they're proper bacilli, sometimes they're coccal bacilli. And so it's on your list of things to think about when you see gram negative coccal bacilli. Often they can have a capsule. They're non-motile organisms, so that differentiates it from some other organisms. So like it's got an example like Legionella or Pseudomonas. They're oxidase negative. So when we think about non-fermenters in general, one of the main biochemical tests that are used is a really quick way to differentiate. And we talked about the Pseudomonas is the oxidase test. So when you get an organism growing on a culture and you get a colony, you do an oxidase test on it. And if it's oxidase positive, you're usually thinking this is Pseudomonas. And if it's oxidase negative, you're usually thinking this isn't Pseudomonas. And the Standards for Microbiological Investigation, the SMI, it's got a really nice flow chart for that in their non-fermenter identification.
SMI. Yeah, which I've got here, but I've also got like a list of the, you know, OxPos and OxNev and OxVariable organisms at the top in a hidden table. So yeah, so Acinetobacterium, Stenotrophomonas, so they're oxidase negative. And Pseudomonas is almost always oxidase positive, and then Burkholderia, it varies. We'll talk about it in the relevant episode.
It's catalase positive is the other thing to think about. And it grows aerobically on agar. Just a side note, catalase is an enzyme that a lot of organisms will use to sort of reduce oxygen-free radicals. So kind of makes sense if something's aerobically growing, it's usually catalase positive.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
I wish there was some way, because sometimes you feel like you just remember the biochemical test results for different organisms, and I find that really difficult unless you're like in the lab doing the lab work all the time. I wish there was some way that you could be like, if you knew something about the organism, you could work it out from first principles. Maybe there's a way of doing that. What does it look like on the agar? So it's a yellow, grayish, white colony, often mucoid, and hemolyticus, so Acinetobacter hemolyticus, is hemolytic, so that makes sense. Beta hemolysis, I presume?
Can't remember, but it's the only one. So it's just a feature of that pretty small fry species.
The way you ID it, so usually you sort of got your sample, which is probably going to be a respiratory tract sample, and let's face it, or it might be a blood culture. From blood culture, it's going to be easy because you'd just be like, oh, there's an organism, we're going to mold it off it. From respiratory tract, the difficulty is that you've got lots of organisms there, so you're not going to mold it off every single thing you're seeing. You're trying to get the wheat from the chaff. So you're going to do oxidase tests on it, and you're going to do a gram stain, and you're going to, you know, recognize it as a gram-negative bacillus that's oxidase negative. And you've got large numbers of growth on, say, a BAL, bronchoalveolar lavage, and then you probably send it off for Molditov. You can also do things like 16S PCR, or you can do a specific PCR for the gyrB.
Yeah, the GYRB, and it's one of the DNA gyrase motifs.
Yeah. And obviously you can do whole genome sequencing as well if you're plush with cash and just want to throw it away. So we're going to Molditov, aren't we? Or you could do other things like, you know, Molditov, so sort of, or APIs. There's lots of ways of doing this. I think most labs now will be sort of Molditoving this.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's Micromode. I flew through that.
We're flying through this episode.
Yeah. What do you want to say about treatment?
Well, if you do want to treat this, you've got options. As long as this thing is not MDR, and as a reminder, 80% of them are MDR, the ones that are isolated from chest. But absolute vanilla Acinetobacter should be sensitive to beta-lactams, in particular, Piptaz, the third-generation cephalosporins and the fourth-gen, Cefiderocol, the Trojan horse, and carbapenems except ertapenem. It's also sensitive to sulbactam. So this is, we'll talk about this in detail later, but ampicillin sulbactam is a beta-lactam, beta-lactamase inhibitor combination. And the sulbactam is part of the sort of first generation of beta-lactamase inhibitors called suicide inhibitors. So essentially they drown the beta-lactamase with substrate. They are the substrate. And they get broken down at the expense of ampicillin. That leaves ampicillin able to target the organism. We've talked about this in the basics of beta-lactamase inhibitors episode, but sulbactam actually has direct activity, particularly against Acinetobacter. It targets one of the PBPs very precisely. And that then means that sulbactam itself can be used as the antibiotic to kill. So for years now, people have been using ampicillin sulbactam, not for the ampicillin, because ampicillin doesn't target Acinetobacter, but for the sulbactam. And there's a recent formulation called sulbactam durlobactam, which we'll be going over later on.
It'd be lovely if we could get those in the UK.
Well, I know. But I think we'll probably be getting sulbactam durlobactam shortly.
You think?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's pretty...
needed.
I think it's needed, and the evidence behind it is pretty about as good as anything else that we're about to discuss.
Just depends if the drug company decides to put it forward for a license. But
true.
Fingers crossed.
In terms of other things that have activity against it, so some of the tetracyclines do, doxycycline and minocycline. aminoglycosides, though resistance rates are really high.
Oh.
Quinolones, like Cipro and Levo, cotrimoxazole and colistin. And there are, what I've included in the show notes that people can take a look at is a table in which I've got all of the agents that we can use, including the UCAST and CLSI breakpoints where applicable. And I found a paper in which there was a breakdown of the kind of frequency of sensitivity of acinetobacter to these agents. So for example, Amicillin sulbactam, if you can use it, it's great, but only about 36% of isolates are sensitive to it. So resistance rates are actually reasonably high. Whereas, say, cefiderocol, the Trojan horse, the sensitivity rates are about 90 to 96%. And so too with colistin. Of course, there are issues with using colistin for lung infections, which might mean that it's not particularly effective.
Hmm.
And then there are some sort of quirks of the particular agency. So CLSI always tends to have more breakpoints than UCAST. UCAST are more circumspect, I guess, you could say. So in particular, UCAST doesn't have breakpoints for the third generation cephalosporins. It does, for cadeforgercol, it's got a recommendation of IE, which is interprets.
IE is insufficient evidence.
Insufficient evidence, yeah. Where CLSI has SR breakpoints of 4 and 16, respectively. For Doripenem, UCAST are recommending using it at higher doses all the time. So they have the S breakpoint set at 0.001. And it doesn't have breakpoints for doxycycline, whereas CLSI does. They're 4 and 16.
Hmm.
Aravacycline, there's a aravacycline review paper for microbiological breakpoints, which I'm referring to for all of the pseudomonads. But it's for UCAST, it's got IE. CLSI don't have a breakpoint set yet, but the MIC90 in that paper was one. So it is worth considering if your back is absolutely to a wall.
Just explain MIC90 quickly for people.
So the MIC, the minimum inhibitory concentration we've mentioned before, it's the concentration of which visible growth is inhibited on an agar plate at 24 hours. The MIC90 would do that to 90% of isolates if you plated out an organism, you know, 100 times. And then looked at, you know, if there was a zone of inhibition, you would hit that at least 90 out of 100 times. So you can get the MIC50, which will do 50% of plated out isolates, and you can get the MIC90. But I think the MIC90 is what the breakpoints are actually based around. So that's that. It's you know.
Well, I want to comment on things. You did right, well. Talking. I sat patiently waiting for you to finish.
You did the whole first half of the episode.
No, I didn't.
Fine. What do you want to ask?
I want to say. Well, first, I want to say the table's lovely. Well done.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's really easy to read, and it's. I'm going to use it. So, thanks. Thanks for helping me.
Well, what I've been doing lately, Calum, is, and the loyal listeners might as well hear this too, is that I've been building the prep notes now in Notion so that hopefully they're a bit more useful to the listener than the old Word documents.
Oh.
And it's also easy if you're looking at it to grab images and tables off, and you can put them into your own notes if you need to.
Yeah.
But yeah, hopefully they're of some use to people.
Can we get sulbactam at the moment in UK? Just no.
So it's not the BNF, Callum, which makes me think that we can't get a hold of it. So at the very least, it would be off license, because if it's not the BNF, it doesn't have a license in the UK. But like all things, like plazomicin and, you know, like other weird and wonderful antimicrobials, if you need it, you can get it. It's just that, you know, it's a historical thing. You know, the UK is addicted to comoxiclav and piperacillin tazobactam. There's not really been much of a use case for Timentin, which is tesarcillin clavulanic acid, or ampicillin sulbactam, you know, until recently. And I think that as we're encountering more and more MDR infections, in particular gram-negative infections, in particular non-fermenters, in particular acinetobacter, the lack of access to sulbactam has become more and more of a problem. But that should be shortly being rectified if the UK knows what's good for it.
And So another question. So I guess this is a big question. Is it's all very well looking at this table, and it's a bit, you know, I find it a bit difficult with UCAS in terms of they're not giving break points for a lot of things now, and that's not particularly helpful. If, you know, I guess it is scientifically sound, but it's not very useful for your job being microbiologist. So if we had a patient who presents with an Acinetobacter infection, let's say it's a VAP, and it was not multi-drug resistant, it wasn't MDR, we had all the options, what's our like go-to, you know, first line treatment? Like what are we going to be giving routinely? I'm thinking PIP/TAZ, although I'm finding that a bit tricky because UCAS don't give a breakpoint, so then I'd have to go to CLSI.
Well, I mean, if it's an ICU patient, they may well already be on PIP/TAZ, but because there's no breakpoint issued by UCAS, no lab will report PIP/TAZ sensitivity. If you ask and you insist, they may report PKP.
Well, we do some sensitivity reporting by CLSI in our lab.
Yeah, yeah. So, and some labs may take the decision to do that, usually out of desperation because UCAS haven't seemed fit to offer anything. But, you know, like if you're just going by this table, you'll probably get a breakpoint for one of the carbapenems, probably imipenem, a quinolone or two, an aminoglycoside, colistin, and Cotrim. So of all of those, I would probably
go to Cotrim.
Cotrim, levofloxacin, and meropenem.
Right. Yeah, and obviously we're trying to avoid, you know, certainly locally we try very hard to avoid to use as little carbapenems as possible, just to try and stop, you know, driving you know, antibiotics in the ICU and driving the you know, because we said earlier on, one of the biggest risk factors for getting Acinetobacter infections is the use of carbapenems.
Yeah.
And it's an environmental organism, and we know that when people are given antibiotics, they excrete that antibiotic in their urine, in their sweat, in their stool.
Yeah.
So it's all over the environment. So the more carbapenems you're using, the more we're going to get Acinetobacter, another, you know, difficult to treat organisms. And then we're saying like, oh, but how do you treat this? You give carbapenems. So you get into this vicious cycle of giving more carbapenems, getting more infections, etc.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but then when you're looking at the rest of the things that UCAS would say are safe to use, you know, aminoglycosides for lung infection, certainly you wouldn't want to use it on its own. And there have been recent changes to the breakpoints, which mean that they wouldn't really consider them or colistin to be ideal.
Mm.
The, you know, lung penetrance of aminoglycosides is about a third. So if you've got, you know, tobramycin or gentamicin, and you're getting a Cmax over MIC of maybe 8 to 10 times, you'll be getting 2 to 3 times in the lung tissue. That's not bad. You'll still be getting some kill, but will you be getting enough to rely on it as your sole, you know, as your sole agent? I'm not sure that I would, you know, and I'm on record as being team aminoglycoside. I'm not even sure that I would want to do that. And then ditto for colistin with Belzon, because it's, you know, it's crap at getting into the lungs, but it's great at getting into your kidneys and causing them to fail. So aminoglycosides are very polarly charged. They've got a high polar charge.
Right.
And so that means that they're difficult crossing some barriers. But I'm going to look into penetrance into alveolar fluid, and we'll do an episode on it later.
That sounds good.
Yeah. So anyway, and looking at the rest of it, you know, ditto for colistin. So then really it's just kind of, you know, you're drawn by default to Cotrim, Cipro, and a carbapenem.
And it has to be Cipro high dose.
Well, I meant levofloxacin.
Oh, I see. So would you use levofloxacin over Cipro for Acinetobacter?
I would. I think it's, particularly in intensive care patients, you can make the argument that, you know, once you've gone broad spectrum, why not try and minimize the amount of antibiotics you need? Do you know what I mean? So like if you're using Cipro, I don't think you would really want to use Cipro on its own. You'd probably want something with a bit of gram-positive cover.
Well, I don't know. If you've got a VAP and you grow an organism on BAL and that's the only thing that you've got,
you could do it. I'm not sure moving from Levo to Cipro I would count as targeted therapy. I think that's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, I don't know. It comes onto the side effect profile.
Yeah. Well, I think that in terms of side effect profile and tendon toxicity and C. diff risk, there's not much difference between the two. The only difference is you're also covering streptococci.
We need to definitely do a deep dive into quinolones, and that's going to come up soon in a future drug episode. And I particularly want to ask a lot of questions about delafloxacin, because that's come up a couple of times recently.
Oh God, I'm going to have to deep dive into dela, am I? Fine, I'll do it. I'll do it. For you, Callum.
Sorry.
For you, I'll do it.
There'll be some red ale in it for when you come up to Edinburgh. Okay, so we've got a bit of an idea about, you know, the approach if you've got a sort of quite a sensitive acinetobacter.
Yeah. Are you happy, Callum?
I'm ecstatic.
Good. Now throw all that out of the window, because this is an absurdly resistant organism and we're all doomed.
Oh, that's a real shame. I wish they would just still say sensitive, to be honest, but that seems hopelessly unrealistic. So I guess you'll need to come back and join us for the next episode, where we're going to talk through the resistance mechanisms and how to manage the crab in the room. So that's the carbapenem resistant Acinetobacter baumannii calcoaceticus complex.
Stay tuned for next week's episode, where Callum finally pronounces it correctly on the first go.
Thank you for listening to the Idiots Podcast, the UK's premier infectious disease podcast. We are supported by the British Infection Association, but they do not have creative control over the episode content, so please don't blame them if we get something wrong.
Questions, comments, suggestions? Why don't you send them in to idiotspodcasting@gmail.com. Have a 5-star review in your pocket? Calm and I would love to have it. Please drop it in your podcast player of choice. We tweet at @idiots_pod. And if you want to donate to support the show, there's a link to do so in the description. But until next time, I'm Jane.
I'm Callum.
See you then.
Now that the episode's done, we hope you learned and had lots of fun. So go forth and treat people with some of what you now know.